The day was supposed to be perfect. A young bride, just hours from saying I do, filled with excitement for the future that awaited her. The courthouse was ready. Her fiancé was waiting. But she never arrived. As time ticked by, concern gave way to unease. Calls went unanswered. And then, sirens. Inside a Bronx apartment, detectives stepped into a nightmare. Blood smeared the floors and walls. The air was thick with the metallic scent of violence. And in the midst of it all, something so disturbing, so deeply unsettling, that even the most seasoned investigators struggled to process what they were seeing. What happened behind that door was far more than a crime. It was a betrayal so cold, so calculated, that it would leave an entire city in shock. Welcome to Behind the Crime, the companion series to Sleuthy Stories, where we go beyond the case and break down key details, theories, and insights. I'm Sleuthy Lucy, and if you're here for expanded discussion, deeper analysis, and the hard truths behind these cases, you're in the right place. If you're new here, welcome. I hope you appreciate today's case coverage and consider subscribing. And for my returning truth seekers, welcome back. It's always good to have you here. Today, we're exposing the unsettling details that made this case so haunting, the deception, the contradictions, and the moments that made investigators stop and question everything. Now let's get into it. Hey there, I'm Sleuthy Lucy, and this is Behind the Crime. The subject of today's investigation, one of the most chilling betrayals imaginable. A young woman, Angelique Sutton, on the happiest day of her life. A wedding, a future, and a trusted friend. But what was supposed to be a joyful celebration turned into an unspeakable act of violence. The accused? That very same friend, Ashley Wade. And what she did has left even seasoned investigators haunted by the details. Spoiler alert. If you haven't watched the Sleuthy Stories episode on this case yet, I highly recommend doing that first. In Behind the Crime, we go straight into the final outcomes, break down the details, and analyze the most pressing questions, so this episode will contain major spoilers. You can find the full case breakdown on my Sleuthy Stories podcast, but if you want to see the visuals that go along with this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. There's a link in the description. This is the story. On November 20th, 2015, in the Bronx, Angelique Sutton was just hours away from what should have been one of the happiest moments of her life, her wedding day. She was 22 years old, deeply in love, and full of excitement about the future. But before heading to the courthouse, she made a brief detour. Prosecutors believe she had gone to pick up a baby gift from someone she had known since childhood, someone she trusted, Ashley Wade. It was a meeting that should have been simple, a moment to reconnect, a kind gesture before a celebration. But what happened behind that closed door was nothing short of horrific. When police arrived at the scene, they stepped into a nightmare. Blood pooled across the floor, smeared the walls, and soaked into the furniture. In the bedroom, a body lay lifeless on the bed, and in another room, an innocent newborn, just minutes old, was being cradled in the arms of the last person anyone would expect. Angelique Sutton lay motionless, her body battered from the brutal attack. The baby had been forcibly removed from her body, and standing in the middle of it all, eerily composed, was Ashley Wade. At first glance, the scene was chaotic, an unthinkable tragedy. But as investigators looked closer, a disturbing reality began to emerge, one that defied logic and reason, one that would send shockwaves far beyond the Bronx. Ashley Wade had never been pregnant. I've spent a lot of hours researching this case, reading through news articles, court documents, and digging through every piece of information I could find. It was unsettling. The more I uncovered, the harder it became to comprehend how something like this could happen. But it did. Ashley Wade had spent months crafting a lie so elaborate that even those closest to her believed it. She posted fake sonograms online, created a baby registry, and built an entire narrative around a pregnancy that never existed. She had planned a future with a child she did not have. And when reality threatened to collapse around her, she did the unthinkable. She found a way to make it real. According to prosecutors, Ashley lured Angelique into her apartment under the guise of a friendly visit. The two had recently reconnected over their shared experiences, spending time together, bonding over what Angelique believed to be their pregnancies. But Ashley had other intentions. When Angelique arrived that day, she had no idea she was walking into a trap. Ashley attacked her, cutting her larynx first to silence her, then severing major blood vessels to ensure she couldn't fight back. It was methodical, surgical, calculated. A crime so precise that prosecutors argued she had researched exactly how to do it. Once Angelique could no longer resist, Ashley performed what can only be described as a crude makeshift C-section. She took a knife and forcibly removed the baby from Angelique's body, a child she had convinced herself was hers. But her brutal act did not stop there. As investigators combed through the apartment, they made an even more disturbing discovery. In the bathroom, Ashley had discarded Angelique's uterus on the floor. The placenta was found in Ashley's bedroom. The sight was so gruesome that officers became nauseous, their stomachs turning at the horror before them. It was the kind of crime that even seasoned detectives struggled to process. In the aftermath of the attack, Ashley called her boyfriend, Angel Prelo, and told him the baby had arrived, that she had just given birth. He rushed to the scene, overjoyed, completely unaware of the nightmare unfolding inside. When he arrived, he found Ashley sitting on the front stoop of her blood-soaked apartment, cradling a newborn in her arms. She handed him the baby, and then the two went inside after she told him she had done, quote, something bad. Shocked by the scene, he took the baby girl outside to wait for help. Meanwhile, detectives pressed on with their investigation, meticulously examining the crime scene. The more they uncovered, such as the absence of defensive wounds on Ashley and the presence of premeditated tools, the clearer it became, this was no spontaneous act of self-defense as Ashley had claimed. This was planned. As the investigation unfolded, it became evident that Ashley had spent months curating this lie, weaving together a false reality so deeply that she may have even convinced herself of its truth. But the truth was undeniable. She had never been pregnant. She had fabricated everything, and she had killed to make her fantasy a reality. The trial that followed was nothing short of harrowing. The prosecution laid out every chilling detail, arguing that this was not a case of mental illness overriding judgment, but a calculated, premeditated murder. They pointed to the fact that Ashley had targeted Angelique's vocal cords first, ensuring she couldn't scream, that she had gone for the major arteries next, ensuring she couldn't fight back, that she had taken deliberate steps to execute the attack with precision, targeting her face and neck while avoiding the baby at all costs. The defense, however, painted a different picture. They claimed Ashley was suffering from severe mental distress, that she had experienced a psychotic break, possibly due to past trauma or a previous miscarriage. They argued that she should not be held fully accountable due to diminished capacity, asserting that her poorly conceived plan indicated a mental impairment that prevented her from fully understanding her actions. But the jury didn't buy it. After deliberating for just 5 hours, they returned with a verdict, guilty of second-degree murder and kidnapping. Ashley Wade was sentenced to 40 years in prison. For some, justice was served. For others, it wasn't enough. But one haunting reality remains. Angelique Sutton was still alive when Ashley performed the crude C-section. She was still conscious when Ashley stood there, lying to her boyfriend about what had just happened. The fact that she may have heard her baby cry, unable to do anything, unable to fight, unable to save herself, is a horror beyond words. She was rushed to the hospital, but despite the paramedics' efforts, she succumbed to her injuries en route and was pronounced dead at Montefiore Hospital. And that is something that will never sit right. This story is so important because it reminds us of two harsh truths. First, not all dangers come from strangers. Sometimes, the greatest betrayals come from the people we trust. And second, the weight of unspoken suffering can be deadly. Ashley Wade's crime didn't come from nowhere. There were layers of deception, emotional distress, and delusions that built up over time. It's a case that sparks so many discussions about mental health, justice, personal safety, and boundaries. And a case that, frankly, left many of you with strong reactions. So let's get into some of those reactions. One comment that really stood out said, "So sad losing a young, beautiful life. I also feel sorry for this killer. I just wish she would have saved herself by getting mental health help. I think this tragedy was caused by emotional suffering." It's a tough comment to unpack, but it raises an important point. Was this crime rooted in untreated emotional suffering? While it's difficult to feel sympathy for someone who committed such a brutal act, mental health struggles don't excuse crimes, but they can sometimes help explain them. Was Ashley Wade dealing with severe emotional distress that pushed her into this violent delusion? Did she truly believe she was pregnant? Or did she know she was lying but felt trapped in her deception? Perhaps the most haunting part of this case is how deeply flawed Ashley's thinking was. The idea that she could commit such a brutal crime in her own home and expect to go on with life as if nothing had happened defies all logic. Did she truly believe no one would come looking for Angelique? That no one would question the bloodied crime scene, the missing woman, or the horrific evidence left behind? It's clear that her sense of reality had completely unraveled, marked by a dangerous mix of desperation, obsession, and delusion. Many people who commit fetal abduction murders don't just wake up one day and decide to do it. There's often a long buildup of emotional suffering, obsessive thinking, and a deep sense of loss or desperation, sometimes tied to a miscarriage, infertility, or relationship turmoil. And in Ashley's case, she had reportedly fabricated an entire pregnancy, fake sonograms, baby clothes, even a nursery. She wasn't just lying to others, she may have been lying to herself. But was she insane? While mental health struggles can be severe, the legal standard for insanity is very specific. In New York, where this case was tried, the insanity defense is based on the McNaughton rule. This rule states that a person can only be considered legally insane if they did not understand the nature of their actions, or they did not understand that their actions were wrong. That's where Ashley's case becomes clear. She knew what she was doing was wrong, and she took deliberate steps to cover up her crime. Someone who is legally insane does not try to hide their crime because they don't see it as a crime. Many who suffer from true insanity admit what they did without fully understanding the weight of it. They might believe they were acting under divine instruction or that they were preventing some imagined harm. But Ashley? She lied. She hid. She manipulated. When police arrived, she desperately tried to maintain her story, telling them she had given birth. It wasn't until detectives confronted her with their suspicions that the baby wasn't hers that she finally admitted she had lied. And even then, she continued to twist the truth. She claimed she wasn't trying to steal a baby, that she had acted in self-defense after Angelique attacked her, and she had only removed the baby to, quote, save her. But if that were true, if she hadn't planned this all along, how do you explain the baby formula, the baby clothes, the fully decorated nursery? How do you explain the months of preparation, the detailed deception, the story she crafted and maintained? How do you explain the fake sonograms she posted, one that she deliberately searched for on Google? The very act of seeking out and using a stolen image demonstrates not just consciousness of guilt, but a calculated effort to maintain her deception. She knew she didn't have a real sonogram of her own, yet she understood that producing one was essential to making her lie believable. This was a carefully crafted illusion designed to keep up the charade. And perhaps the biggest question, how do you explain that Ashley conveniently scheduled her due date to align with Angelique's? This wasn't just a disturbing coincidence. It was a calculated decision. Ashley Wade knew when Angelique's baby was expected to arrive, and she made sure that her fake pregnancy timeline matched it perfectly. That way, when she suddenly had a baby in her arms, it wouldn't raise suspicion. These weren't last-minute actions taken in a panic. They were carefully orchestrated steps laid out by someone who had been planning for the moment she would take Angelique's baby and claim her as her own. These are not the actions of someone unaware of what they were doing or oblivious to its consequences. Every move Ashley made was covert, calculated, and deliberate, a clear indication of intent and premeditation, even if deeply flawed in execution. Everything, the lies, the deception, the cover-up, all pointed to one chilling truth. Ashley Wade always intended to, quote, save Angelique's baby. But in reality, she wasn't saving anything. She was stealing a life while destroying another. Many others. Another comment that stood out said, I feel like more charges would have added more time to the sentence, like performing medical procedures without a license or endangering a fetus or child. And that's a valid point. Ashley Wade's crime was multi-layered, involving murder, kidnapping, assault, and even elements of medical mutilation. Yet, at trial, she was convicted of only second-degree murder and kidnapping. So why didn't prosecutors add more charges? Why wasn't she charged with something like performing an unlicensed surgical procedure? The answer lies in how prosecutors approach criminal cases. When building a case, prosecutors don't necessarily throw every possible charge at a defendant, although in some cases, it may seem like that. Instead, they prioritize the strongest charges, the ones they have the most evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. This is why we sometimes see a seemingly lesser number of charges, even in complex cases. Take the Diddy case, for example. There have been many wild accusations circulating in the media. Yet in his federal case, the charges have been streamlined to racketeering, sex trafficking, forced labor, kidnapping, arson, bribery, and obstruction of justice. That's a lot, but they could have added a host of other charges to this list, such as money laundering, wire fraud, conspiracy to commit fraud, witness tampering, tax evasion, drug distribution, and perjury, but they didn't. Why? Because prosecutors go for what they can win. In Ashley's case, prosecutors focused on murder and kidnapping because murder was the clearest, strongest charge. Her intent to kill Angelique was undeniable. Kidnapping fit because she physically took the baby by force. Other potential charges, like performing an unlicensed surgical procedure or assaulting a fetus, wouldn't have added significantly more time to her sentence and might have introduced unnecessary legal complications. While it feels like more charges would equal more justice, prosecutors are strategic. They build their cases around what will lead to a clear conviction rather than overcomplicating the case with lesser charges that might not hold up in court. That's why Ashley's trial focused on second-degree murder and kidnapping, because those were the charges that ensured she would be held accountable in the strongest way possible. Initially, Ashley Wade was charged with first-degree murder, but by the time she went to trial, prosecutors reduced the charge to second-degree murder. So, why the change? The answer lies in New York's strict legal definition of first-degree murder. Unlike many states where premeditation alone qualifies a killing as first-degree murder, New York law is much more specific. Under New York Penal Law, Section 125.27, first-degree murder only applies under certain circumstances, such as the murder of a police officer, judge, corrections officer, or other protected class, a murder for hire or contract killing, a murder involving torture, a murder committed during another violent felony, for example, robbery, sexual assault, terrorism, kidnapping, or a multiple victim killing. Because Ashley was not targeting a law enforcement officer, torturing Angelique over an extended period, or committing another felony at the moment of the murder, under New York's legal definition, prosecutors couldn't justify a first-degree murder charge. Uncovering this information got me thinking. Ashley killed Angelique and also kidnapped her baby. So why didn't this qualify for a first-degree felony murder? I found that a key distinction in New York's felony murder rule is the difference between a murder that happens during a felony versus a felony that happens after a murder. Think of it this way. Imagine an individual commits a robbery, and during the robbery, someone is unintentionally killed. In this scenario, because the death occurred during the commission of the felony, which is robbery, the felony murder rule would apply, potentially elevating the charge to murder. Now, suppose an individual intentionally kills someone and then decides to commit a felony, such as burglary, to cover up the crime. Here, the murder preceded the felony, meaning the felony murder rule would not apply in the same way, as the death did not occur during the commission of the felony. In Ashley's case, she committed murder first, cutting Angelique's throat and fatally attacking her. Then she kidnapped the baby. Since the murder occurred before the kidnapping, rather than as part of the kidnapping itself, prosecutors likely determined that it did not meet the legal definition of felony murder in New York. To many, this seems counterintuitive. If Ashley's entire purpose was to steal the baby, shouldn't the murder have been seen as part of that crime? New York's first-degree felony murder charge typically applies when the victim who dies is killed during the commission of the felony itself, not before or after. If Ashley had kidnapped the baby first and then killed Angelique in the process of escaping, it might have met the requirements for first-degree felony murder. However, because prosecutors saw the murder as a separate act committed before the kidnapping took place, they likely felt it was more legally sound to pursue second-degree murder and kidnapping as separate charges rather than attempt to prove felony murder under New York's narrow criteria. Because the primary crime was the murder itself, and the kidnapping was a secondary crime, prosecutors likely felt it was cleaner and stronger to charge Ashley with second-degree murder and kidnapping separately. Then I wondered, could prosecutors have argued that Ashley tortured Angelique? The way Ashley carried out the attack was undeniably methodical and horrific. First, she cut Angelique's larynx, ensuring she couldn't scream for help. Then, she targeted her major blood vessels, weakening her so she couldn't fight back. She proceeded to perform a crude C-section, removing Angelique's uterus, leaving it discarded on the floor. She forcibly removed the baby while Angelique was still alive. She stood there telling lies to her boyfriend about what had just happened, all while Angelique was likely conscious, unable to move, unable to speak, and suffering. Given the sheer brutality and suffering involved, it feels like it could qualify as torture. However, under New York's legal definition, torture in a first-degree murder charge requires an intent to cause prolonged pain or suffering that goes beyond just killing the victim. This is where it gets legally complex. Ashley's actions were undeniably depraved and methodical, but the prosecution would have had to prove that her intent was to prolong Angelique's pain, not just to kill her quickly to steal the baby. If Ashley knew Angelique was alive and continued her actions anyway, it could support a torture argument. However, if prosecutors couldn't prove intent to prolong suffering, it could have weakened the case. Could it have been argued? Yes. Would it have stuck? maybe not. There's no doubt that what Angelique endured was agonizing. A strong argument could have been made that Ashley knew she was still alive and continued mutilating her, meaning she was knowingly causing extreme pain. However, legally, prosecutors had to choose the charge that would guarantee conviction. Second-degree murder was the strongest, most bulletproof charge under New York law, ensuring Ashley Wade would not walk free. Another comment that stood out was, "I wish she had gotten life without parole or the death penalty. I've seen people get more time for way less of a crime. It was premeditated, months in the making. I personally don't understand. It's a sentiment a lot of people share. 40 years to life feels too lenient for a crime this horrific. The premeditation, the deception, the sheer brutality, many feel Ashley Wade deserved more. So why wasn't she sentenced to life without parole or even the death penalty? In New York, life without the possibility of parole is only an option for first-degree murder convictions. As we've discussed, Ashley's charge was second-degree murder, which meant the maximum possible sentence she could receive was 25 years to life. And the judge actually went beyond that, giving her 40 years to life. This means Ashley must serve at least 40 years before she is even eligible for parole. She will be in her 60s when she first gets the chance to plead her case for release. Could the judge have given her more? Not under New York law. Second-degree murder does not allow for life without parole. It carries a maximum of 25 to life, and Ashley's sentence already exceeded that. So why not the death penalty? New York abolished the death penalty in 2007, meaning it was never an option for Ashley's case. Even if it had still been on the books, New York's death penalty was only used in very limited circumstances, usually for cop killings or terrorism-related murders. So while many people feel Ashley deserved a harsher punishment, the reality is her sentence was as severe as legally possible under New York law. Ashley will be eligible for parole in 2055. At that point, she will have to go before a parole board and argue why she should be released. But given the nature of this crime, public outrage, and the brutal evidence, there's a strong chance she will be denied. Ultimately, the parole board has the final say, but Ashley's actions were so calculated and disturbing that many believe she will never walk free. This next comment is one I think a lot of people resonated with. "I wish Angelique had listened to her friend's advice and stayed away. I'm certain an argument broke out because Ashley's boundaries weren't respected." This comment is particularly haunting given what we now know about that day. It was actually Angelique who suggested stopping by Ashley's apartment. Ashley told her she wasn't in the mood for company, mentioning that she had just had an argument with her boyfriend, Angel. Despite this, Angelique still planned to visit. This raises an important question. Was Angelique simply being a good friend, or did Ashley subtly pull her in? By mentioning her fight with Angel, was Ashley just venting, or was she laying a trap? Had she learned how to play into Angelique's natural kindness, saying just enough to make her feel needed, but not enough to raise suspicion? Angelique's loved ones described her as someone who always showed up for others. She was compassionate, thoughtful, and deeply loyal. Did Ashley know this and use it against her? Did Angelique feel a sense of obligation to check on Ashley, believing she needed support? Also, did she dismiss any gut feelings of unease, assuming she was just being a caring friend? These are difficult questions, and while we may never have definitive answers, they reinforce an important reality. Manipulation doesn't always look like manipulation. It often disguises itself as vulnerability, nostalgia, or even love. The key takeaways? Angelique didn't do anything wrong. She had no reason to believe that offering kindness would lead to harm, but if there's anything we can take away from this, it's that it's okay to say no. It's okay to trust your instincts, even when it feels uncomfortable, and it's okay to prioritize your safety, even at the risk of hurting someone's feelings. Too often, people, especially women, feel guilty about setting boundaries, afraid of seeming rude or unkind. However, simply having a shared history with someone doesn't automatically ensure your safety. Ashley was someone Angelique had known since childhood. That familiarity may have made it harder for her to see the danger. But at the end of the day, our intuition exists for a reason. If something feels off, listen to that feeling. You don't owe anyone access to your time, energy, or presence, especially if something inside you is telling you to take a step back. Because the truth is, a real friend will respect your boundaries. A dangerous person will test them. I hope this episode has addressed some of the burning questions we've all had about this case. Remember, your thoughts and insights are invaluable to me. Please share them in the comments below. Let's continue this conversation together. That wraps up this episode of Behind the Crime, where we take a deeper look at the cases covered in Sleuthy Stories. If you enjoyed this breakdown, be sure to follow the Sleuthy Stories podcast so you never miss an episode. And if there's a detail or theory you'd like to discuss further, let me know. I love hearing your thoughts. Until next time, stay safe, stay aware, and take care.